is holding on to the past. And nobody says at the end of their life, what I really am happy I did all my life is hold on to my regrets.
Welcome to the Psychology Podcast. Today we welcome Dr. Robert L. Leahy to the show. Dr. Leahy is the director of the American Institute for Cognitive Therapy, NYC, and clinical professor of psychology and psychiatry at Weill Cornell University Medical School. Dr. Leahy serves on a number of scientific committees for international conferences on cognitive behavioral therapy and is a frequent keynote speaker throughout the world. He has authored 27 books about CBT, depression, worry, anxiety, and emotion regulation, which have been translated in 20 languages. His latest book is called If Only, Finding Freedom from Regret. In this episode, I talk to Dr. Leahy about finding freedom from regret. Regret is an unpleasant emotion that can motivate us to learn and grow, but there are times when it can keep us frozen in place. According to Dr. Leahy, this is why it's important to make a distinction between productive and unproductive rumination. He shares the cognitive biases we have about loss and opportunity, as well as strategies on how to let go of regret when it no longer serves us. I really enjoyed chatting with Robert. He and I go way back, actually, and he's been on the podcast before, and his work has really influenced me even before I met him and really deeply helped me overcome a lot of anxiety I was experiencing many years ago. So I find his work really impactful, and I found this discussion, which is an extension of his prior work to the realm of regret, really quite profound, and it had a really deep existential psychology flavor, which you all know I like. So I think you'll really enjoy this podcast as well, and I hope you find it useful for your own life and finding a life without living it with regret. So without further ado, I bring you Dr. Robert Leahy.
Hey, Robert, thanks so much for being on the Psychology Podcast.
Well, Scott, thanks for having me on again. It's great to see you.
Great to see you, too. Wow, lots of change in the world since the last time we talked. But you have this new book called If Only, Finding Freedom from Regret. Why do you decide to write this book? Like, when did the idea come to you?
Well, you know, it's interesting, Scott. I see patients every week, and many of the patients I've seen over the many years of practice express regret about things they did or did not do, or they anticipate if they make a change, they're going to have a lot of regrets. And so from a cognitive behavioral point of view, I was curious. That didn't seem to be very much in the literature. So I decided to do a deep dive. And I like writing books that are going to make me learn about things that I think are relevant to everyday life. So that's kind of where I came from on it.
Yeah, you write regret is an emotion that comes with living a full life.
Yeah,
you wrote that deep into your book. You wrote that sentence. Wow, I mean, that's a powerful sentence. Why is that? I mean, why is that so important from living a full life?
Well, because a full life includes mistakes, and regrets could be mistakes that we made or anticipate making. We're not going to be batting 1,000. Things are not going to turn out to be exactly what we want. In my view, no one's going to get exactly what they want in their terms in life. And so we have regrets because we make decisions to either make a change or not make a change. And then we're not always pleased with the outcome. And so it's, you know, some people say, oh, I don't have any regrets because, I figure I made the decision myself. That's the very nature of regret. You made the decision. And if you don't have any regrets, how are you going to learn from your experience? You know, I view regrets as part of the trial and error learning of everyday life, which we all go through.
Well, your book is very unique because you bring this clinician perspective to it, and you bring it, you've had a lot of personal experience and practice on this. You also come from a background on helping people with anxiety. As I told you in your last podcast, your book on anxiety really helped me a lot in my life a long time ago when I was studying at Cambridge University. I was seeing a therapist there. We were working through the book. Your work on anxiety has been very important, and I see I see threads of it in this book. You've applied some of those cognitive behavioral therapy ways of thinking into the realm of regret. So that's unique.
Yeah, a lot of the regret literature is, you know, surveys about what people regret, or, you know, do we regret taking action to make a change or not taking action. There's a lot of research in the cognitive literature in the behavioral economics on regret. But in the clinical literature, there's very little. And I view regret, when you think about regret as part of living a full life, you know, if you look at it from an evolutionary point of view, you have to ask why any emotion evolved. I mean, why is jealousy a pretty universal emotion, or envy, or resentment, or the desire for revenge? And regret is a universal emotion. It's like you're not going to find any culture that regret is not part of the experience. It's the second most commonly mentioned emotion, love being the first. So you have this ubiquitous emotion that people get hijacked by. And then, you know, you need to understand what the logic is of regret, that there's a reason why people regret. They, in fact, in one survey, they actually found that regret of the unpleasant emotions was rated the most valuable, because people felt like, I can learn from it, I can make myself a better person, it's a way of being responsible. So it's kind of like, it's, you know, to say that I never regret, I'm kind of, well, don't you learn from experience, or don't you ever apologize to people for things that you've said? So it's part of, I think, the wide range of sometimes unpleasant emotions that make sense and may be adaptive if used in the right way. But then some people get hijacked by the regret and they just ruminate and become self-critical and become frozen in their paths.
And frozen in their past.
And their path. Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. But I'm saying and. Yes. And frozen in their past.
Oh, well, frozen in their past. Yes. Absolutely.
They can't seem to stop feeling like a loser for what they did 20 years ago. And it's still part of their self schema is loser. Now, I don't know who I'm thinking of there. Yeah. I don't know where that example came from. But yes, speaking for a friend.
This friend of ours really has a lot of problems, you know?
Yeah, seriously. So some of what you're talking about actually dovetails nicely with the emerging field of post-traumatic growth.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that connection as well?
Well, now that you mention it, I mean, you can really see that, like if you take the pandemic, the last 2.5 years and maybe the next year and a half or so, that a lot of us had to go through incredible adaptation. So many people went through losses. Over 1 million people in the United States have died. But there's also growth that a lot of us could experience from that, you know, kind of prioritizing what's important. You know, is it important to have, you know, expensive clothes or drive an expensive car or climb the corporate ladder or, you know, impress people? Or is it important to stay alive and to appreciate kind of simple things in life and be flexible? And one of the things that I find with regret is that regret is often tied to these inflexible expectations about what my life must be. If you were flexible about the outcome of your decisions, and you can look at outcomes in terms of what I call relative preferences, like you would like 100%, but you're willing to accept 90%, 80%, 70%, you're going to be able to have a lot more satisfaction in life. And one of the things that we see with decision making and regret is that some people are what's called maximizers. They want the absolute best. They have to have the absolute best.
Yeah, that's me.
Is that you, Scott? The absolute best?
Oh, yeah. I always want the best clothing and fashion. No, I'm joking. I'm joking. Look at me. Look at me.
You got to do some stand-up comedy, Scott.
I do, actually. Do you know what
I do? No, I've got to see it. Put it on TikTok.
That will never be shown on the internet.
Oh, come on.
But I do.
Okay, we'll have to do a shame exercise with you. But the thing that's interesting is that these maximizers, this is a concept that Herbert Simon came up about 60, 70 years ago, got the Nobel Prize in economics. You know, the maximizer is looking for the absolute best. And the maximizer thinks, if I really try to get all the information and can do all the comparisons and demand the best, I won't have regrets. I'll be satisfied. And what the research shows is that the maximizers take longer to make decisions, and they're less satisfied with the outcome. And they're even less satisfied with the outcome, even if the outcome is objectively better than an outcome that somebody who's a satisfier might have chosen. So it's kind of like, you know, trying for the best leads often to more dissatisfaction and more regret and more procrastination.
Oh boy, I'm so glad you mentioned and Herb Simon and gave him credit, because a lot of people who talk about that that wonderful framework, maximizing for satisfying, don't give Herb Simon that credit. A little Jeopardy trivia: I was Herb Simon's last research assistant.
Oh my God!
Before he died,
amazing.
Before he died at Carnegie Mellon.
That's incredible. Yeah, what a coincidence! Jeez.
He was one of my first big mentors in the field of psychology, and yeah, just a wonderful person.
Wow. Wow.
And researcher. Yeah. Okay. So does anticipating regret lead you to action or inaction?
You know, people often think about regret, about decisions I made in the past and the outcomes in the past. But anticipating regret is a big part of regret theory, actually. It's that, like, people often will view making a change in terms of a loss frame. Like, for example, somebody thinking about breaking up in a relationship, getting a divorce or whatever it would be, they may often think about what I'm losing, which of course is always true. There are always trade-offs, right, between staying and leaving. Yeah. So people anticipating regretting their decision, there's kind of an inhibition of making a change because it's often viewed as a loss frame. And what we know from the research, and there's a lot of cross-cultural research that people have done on this, that people anticipate making a change will lead to more regret. In the short term, there is more regret that a person experiences making a change in the short term. In the long term, as people look back on their lives, people are more likely to regret what they did not do. They did not make the change. They did not pursue the other job. They did not break off the relationship or whatever. They regret what they did not do. And this is true in all cultures, so that have been studied. So it's an interesting asymmetry, you know, because we often think that if I make that change, I'll get stuck. And I think this is where a lot of the interesting work on emotional theory that you're familiar with, the affective forecasting work, that, you know, people predicting their emotion, like, if I do this, like Dan Gilbert's work, if I do this, I'll have regrets. And what Gilbert and Wilson and others have found, that, you know, people anticipate far more regrets than they actually have. But we also tend to overpredict how extreme our emotion will be, how happy we'll be, how unhappy we'll be. So if we get that new house, we're going to be really, really happy forever, like a durability illusion. I'll be happy forever if I move to Santa Monica, California, you know, I'll be unhappy forever if I lose money in the market or if I go through this breakup. Mm. And so when people make a decision or they anticipate regret, they're often overpredicting their emotions, and they often overpredict the impact, how serious and how durable, how extreme that emotion is going to be. And they don't consider the different ways that I can cope. So when I'm talking to somebody thinking about, you know, divorcing, you know, he talks about missing his children, which is understandable and kind of a good value, but doesn't give as much value to the idea of having fewer conflicts with his partner and having new opportunities moving forward. So, you know, and you can imagine that if somebody stays in an unhappy relationship for 10, 15, 20 years, they're beginning to build up a savings account of more regrets. So we often have to think about, ways that we can cope with making change. And I think this is where the work on resilience comes in. We often underestimate how resilient we are. You know, the work of George Bonanno at Columbia. And George's work indicates remarkably that it's like 80-85% of people going through what we might consider a major negative life event a year after are back to their pre-event psychological well-being. So regret, about anticipated regret, we often underestimate our resilience. And, you know, It's kind of like a hedonic treadmill. We we generally will eventually get used to what we have, whether it's good or bad.
It is like the hedonic treadmill, and it also seems to relate to Daniel Gilbert's work on affective forecasting.
This is the kind of thing that I think in the clinical area, Scott, is so important to incorporate. You know, how we think about emotions, how we think about our emotions in the future, and because we often get anchored to an emotion, and we look at the future through the lens of our current emotion. So one thing that I've been interested in for years is how depressed people make decisions, because it's like a depressive paradox. You would think, why would you continue criticizing yourself because that's not rewarding? Or why would you continue avoiding things because you're not getting rewards? So it seemed like a paradox. I mean, it seemed like the opposite of the law of effect. But what depressive avoidance is about is avoiding further loss. And it's kind of like if you've gone from 80% positive to 20% positive, you're going to be hesitant to take the risk to make a change, because if you lose that 20% positive that you have left, you're going to think that life is not worth living. So there's kind of a depressive, you know, depressed people are more prone to regret. They criticize themselves. Part of the Beck depression inventory. They criticize themselves. They anticipate more regret. They don't think that they can handle difficulties. They don't think that they're going to enjoy positives, and they think that they're going to suffer their losses more than enjoy their gains. So there's a logic to depressive avoidance and passivity.
Has the research shown the causal direction there? Which is the chicken, which is the egg?
Yeah, that's something, it's more correlational. I've done some research on that over the years, and I know DeRubis and other people have done some research on it. But it's an interesting thing, because in therapy, we're always trying to get patients to make decisions, right? You kind of wonder, why would this person who's depressed not want to make a change? People who are anxious are afraid of surprise. They're afraid of delta. They're afraid of, don't get my hopes up too much, because then if things don't work out, I'll be really traumatized by the surprise. And that's what they would regret.
It's so interesting. So much of this really does pivot around the maximizing versus satisficing distinction. Like the whole book kind of pivots around that, because if you don't really expect anything good out of your life, and everything that happens is even a little bit good, you're like, oh, that's nice.
One of the things that I discuss in the book is what I call, existential perfectionism. I'm sure you've seen this both in LA and in New York. We're kind of like the ground zero for existential perfectionism. Like, my life has to be just great. My job has to be fulfilling all the time, where I live and my appearance and my partner and all that. It's kind of existential, like the Holy Grail myth, chasing after, it's what one of your guests recently talked about, toxic positivity, which I love that concept. And you can see this existential perfectionism as part of regret. Oh, my partner is not perfect. My job is not perfect. I'm not perfect and all that. What I would love you to do is go out and survey people you know well and find out which of them have perfect lives. And even if you want to go out and ask Bill Gates, is his life perfect? Through a divorce and dealing with his kids, so we kind of idealize celebrities and things on social media. I had a patient a number of years ago who, divorced guy about in his late 50s, and he was thinking about the woman he was dating, their positives and negatives. He said, what's the key to a good relationship? And I said, I used to do a lot of windsurfing, and I was down in St. John in the Virgin Islands. I wanted to learn how to windsurf in heavy waves and heavy wind. So I went to the other side of the island, Coral Bay, and there's this guy, Mike, who is the windsurf hot dog on the island. So I said, Mike, what's the key to windsurfing in strong winds and heavy waves? He said, Bob, it's rock and roll and commit to the action. And I said to this guy, I said, that's the key to a good relationship. Rock and roll and commit to an action. So he put on a screensaver a picture of a guy windsurfing in heavy winds. But it's kind of like, nice. You say when you get married, happily ever after. It should be for ups and downs ever after.
There you go. Right? Yeah. So it seems like a lot of people are looking for the free lunch. They're looking for the no trade-off option. Are you saying that people should stop that search?
If you're looking for the free lunch, you're going to starve.
Damn. Getting a little sassy over there. Sassy Robert.
You know, it's all about...
He's a snap.
You know, the free lunch myth. It's all about trade-offs, you know. It's kind of like, you know, Kierkegaard said, if you get married, you'll regret it. If you don't marry, you'll regret it. I was talking with a patient a number of years ago, a really good guy, had sounded like a good relationship with this woman he knew for several years. And he said, I don't know if I can get married because I have some ambivalence. And he equated ambivalence with, I can't make a decision if I'm ambivalent. And of course, the word decision in Latin actually means to cut away from something. So if you're making a decision, by definition, you had ambivalence at the moment you made the decision. So decisions are all about trade-offs, you know, that yes. Looking for the perfect partner, he could spend the next 30 years, you know, and if he found somebody who thought was really good, he could then say, well, maybe there's somebody better. This kind of receding reference point, like these guys, you know, are in their fourth or fifth marriages or whatever, as opposed to thinking about the trade-offs, the pros and cons. And I said, the reason that you're ambivalent is that you know each other. We often think about Romeo and Juliet as, oh, that's the kind of way you should feel if you make a lifelong commitment. Romeo and Juliet is about a 13-year-old and a 15-year-old who see each other from the distance at a party with opposing families and fall in love based on absolutely nothing. And then within 4 or 5 days, several people are killed, including Romeo and Juliet. And some people during Shakespeare's time actually thought the point that he was trying to make was to make fun of this idealized romantic infatuation. Why not wait 6 months and get to know each other before you end up killing yourself? So it's the idea that there's a free lunch, there's no trade-offs, the Holy Grail, the receding reference point, there's always somebody better. There are like 5 or 6 billion people in the world. What's the likelihood that you have found the absolute best person in the world? Right? Zero.
Thanks for all your great romanticism today, Robert.
I am a romantic. But
what's the chances that your wife is really the best person for you? Probably zero.
No, she is the best person for me. But there's the opportunity cost of searching, right? So if people... Yeah. Look for the next best option, there's a cost to searching. And don't have the commitment. You spend a lot of time chasing down dead ends.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's what my friend tells me. Yeah. It happens in the dating market.
Yeah.
Again, the friend. But but there's positives there as well, like freedom and no commitment.
The trade-offs of being single.
There could be trade-offs there. I really like this phrase, action inertia. Is this a psychological principle that the longer you wait, the longer you want to wait for something?
Yeah, it's sort of the habit of not doing something. And it's kind of like when you practice a bad habit, I mean, one of the advantages of avoidance, this is the O.J. Maurer approach, an old Yale professor of psychology about, you know, two-factor learning, that you think about making a change, but you say, oh, no, that's going to be unpleasant, you avoid. What you do, your anxiety goes down when you avoid. And so you basically reinforce avoidance. So the inertia becomes the habit. And the inertia becomes, I mean, one of the examples of this is the sunk cost effect, which I discuss in the book, which is that everybody knows what this is. You buy a jacket or a dress or whatever, and you take it, you pay a lot of money, you take it home. Try it on. You say, oh, no, I'm not going to. It's not me right today. That's not for me. I'll do it some other time. You put it in your closet and you have it in your closet for 5 years. And then your partner says, why don't you get rid of that? You haven't worn it 5 years. Oh, no, I can't get rid of it. I paid good money for it. What you're doing is you're holding on to something because you had a prior investment in it. And you see people doing this with careers, with relationships, with their, you know, PCs or whatever it would be. I can't make a change because I put all this time in it. And I think part of it is the inaction inertia that you've kind of gotten used to staying. You have a loss frame You think that change is going to be a loss. You have a fear of wasting. I mean, one example I think of, like if I had a $100 bill and I said, you know, Scott, I like burning money in front of people and I'm going to burn this $100 bill. I'll bet you would probably think I'm a little crazy and you'd be correct, but you might be a little bit angry with me. We don't like the idea of people burning money. You're not going to be worse off. No one else will be worse off, but there's this kind of intrinsic fear of wasting that people have. And so if I get rid of something, if I put 5 years in a relationship or 5 years in a job or career or whatever, or course of study, I think, oh, I wasted it. So it's very hard to walk away from a prior commitment.
Well, what is the hindsight bias and how does that relate to this? Because that's different than the sunk cost.
Yeah, exactly. The hindsight bias is like, you know, it's like people discussing the baseball or football game on that was on Sunday. They discuss it on Monday and they knew everything was going to happen the way it was. Or, you know, people like Bob Shiller at Yale got the Nobel Prize in economics, looked at the hindsight bias. Almost everybody was saying after the market crashed in 2008, oh yeah, I knew it was, so I got out, right? Everybody got out of the market? No, they didn't. They lost trillions of dollars. So hindsight bias is that we reconstruct our knowledge about yesterday from what we know now. And of course, I'm really great at predicting what I had for dinner last night, right? But I'm not going to be good at predicting what the weather is going to be like next week. So hindsight bias is part of regret. It's like, oh, I should have known that my partner was going to be an alcoholic, or I should have known that that investment would have failed. When you made the decision in the past, you made the decision based under conditions of uncertainty with the information that was available, trying to make the best outcome. And there were other people making that decision.
Well, then we get into the whole free will issue. The decision had already been made for you going all the way back to the Big Bang. You know, I try to link your work to lots of other areas of research as you've seen today. Another one is I've wondered if you've thought about linking it to Kristen Neff's self-compassion work at all, because what advice do you have for people who, let's say they did something genuinely terrible when they're younger? How can they still see themselves as a positive self-concept in the present when they keep ruminating over the past? Can they? Is there hope for that?
Yeah, so, you know, Paul Gilbert, who originated compassion-focused therapy, is an old friend of mine. And, you know, the idea of compassion, I bring up compassion in the book, you know, directing it toward ourselves or directing it toward other people. But I would have even expanded the compassion into the idea of self-forgiveness. And humility. You know, there's a concept that I found very useful with myself and with patients I work with, which I would call, you know, adaptive humility. Adaptive humility is that I'm just a human being. I'm no better than other people. I'm going to make mistakes. I can learn from things. I need to forgive others if I'm going to forgive myself. All of this. You know, there's some research on humility that shows that people who have this adaptive humility, I don't mean people who are have low self-esteem or don't assert themselves, and people have this adaptive humility, kind of a humanizing universal compassion. These people have better marriages, better friendships, and it stands to reason. I mean, if you're like, okay, yeah, I'm a fallen angel, just like my partner or my friend, and I can direct compassion toward myself. And compassion doesn't mean I get a free ride. Forgiveness doesn't mean I get a free ride. It means that okay, I realized I said something that was unfair or mean-spirited or just plain wrong, but I want to become a better person, and this is an opportunity for me to learn from that. It's an opportunity for me to correct myself rather than criticize myself. The world's not going to be a better place if I hate myself, but it could be a better place if I practice compassion toward myself and others. Thinking about forgiveness as a strength that you have in life. I'll give you an example of my own life. We were staying at a hotel recently and the internet was not working. It was an expensive place. And I was kind of irritated. And I was talking with the woman downstairs in charge. In my view, I was very rude to her. I mean, not terribly, but I was rude. And I came back to the room and I was talking with my wife and I was justifying myself. you know, well, you know, paying a lot of money, they should have this. And then I thought, you know, if I were watching myself, I would have thought that guy's acting like a jerk. And I said, I don't want to be the kind of person that when I'm thinking about my behavior toward somebody who's innocent, trying to do her job, you know, is being treated like in some kind of like some guy, you know, with a power assertion type thing. So I immediately called downstairs and I asked to speak with her and I apologized. And she was actually quite gracious in accepting my apology. And I'm grateful for that. But the ability to kind of recognize it, you know, it was a really bad thing I did. I shouldn't treat anybody that way. I would never want to be treated that way. This is adaptive humility. I'm not a saint, but it was an opportunity for me to sort of say, yeah, that's a regret that I need to do something about that. I need to ask her to forgive me.
Love that. If that's the worst thing you've ever done in your whole life, though, I'd say you're pretty good. Okay, good, pretty good person. Well, look, this also gets into the distinction you make in your book that I love between productive and unproductive rumination, right? Yeah. I mean, you're just being proactive about it. Well, you say adaptive. Yeah, productive, adaptive, same shit. Let's have the audience learn how to step away from rumination. And I'm going to read some of my favorites from your book. Imagine that your rumination thought is a balloon. You can let go.
Now,
I love that.
You know why
one.
You love that? Because you're creative.
I am.
But I've used that with.
Yeah. You can tell I'm creative.
No, I'm just guessing. I can tell by the books on your shelf back there. It's interesting because when I've used that with people who have an artistic sentiment, they really, really resonate to it. That's the one thing. Oh, I love the thought balloon. You know, that rumination or that worry or that regret. I'm holding on to that balloon. And now I'm letting it go and I'm seeing it float in the sky. And it's kind of like this visceral feeling of watching your worries go away. It doesn't necessarily work like that, but it gives you this sort of like fluidity in imagery. And I bet you do a lot of visual imagery. Like when you recollect something, when I listen to music, I have visual imagery of things that occur.
Love that one. You write letting go is the opposite of regret. So tell us a little bit about the letting go part.
You know, regret is being anchored to the past. And as one comedian said, the only reason to live in the past is the rent was cheaper. So, but you know, it's an interesting thing because regret is holding on to the past. And nobody says at the end of their life, what I really am happy I did all my life is hold on to my regrets, you know?
Yeah.
If you think about things that annoyed you in the past or that upset you in the past, very likely at the time you had this intense emotion, you thought this is going to go on forever. But today you hardly ever think of them. And we ask, you know, why do you no longer think about what you were worried about when you were at Cambridge University or living in London or whatever? Because you moved past it, you put it in perspective, you pursued other positive goals. You no longer held on to it. One of the goals in life, this is a technique that I've used with people, is the indifference technique. What would be the advantage of being indifferent to your regrets, right? As opposed to actually caring a lot about them and having to have a dialogue with your regrets and, you know, having this voice in your head about what an idiot you are for making those mistakes. Become indifferent about the mistakes that I made or things that happened in the past or people treating me unfairly. We often think about indifference as like, surrendering or being defeated as opposed to rising above. And if you think about the image, because you're an imagery person, Scott, about the image, it's like one technique, that I've used is thinking about yourself as, you know, you're up in a balloon, a lighter than air balloon. You're up about, you know, 4,000 feet and you're looking down at these events. You know, you're up in the balcony looking down and, you know, you're up in space looking down at the earth. And so you get this sort of emotional distance, this perspective of letting go. And you've let go of almost everything, but you, because you let it go, you don't even realize you let it go.
Okay. Let it go. I like that. I really do like that. Here's another one of my favorite ones. Flood yourself with the feared thought. The boredom technique. That one, by the way, that was, I believe, in your anxiety book. And that helped me a lot.
It's kind of the ultimate indifference, isn't it? It's kind of like, it's an exposure technique. It's like, you know, the boredom technique with regret could be, yes, I made a stupid decision that I shouldn't have made. Boy, I said it just now, and all of a sudden I'm feeling pretty bad. But what if you repeat it slowly like a zombie 200 or 300 times every day? I made a stupid mistake and I shouldn't have made it. You eventually become indifferent to it. It's like it becomes white noise. And people are often, when I introduce the boredom technique, whether it's for worry or jealousy or envy or regret, whatever, or resentment, they initially think, oh my God, that's going to make everything worse. You're asking me to really repeat my negative thoughts. But if I ask you to get on the elevator 200 times, you might initially be anxious. But after the 10th time, you say, Bob, I think I got this. I think I understand.
Yeah.
I know what exposure is. I don't need the extra 180 exposures.
Yes, I love it. Some comedians say that, you know, they would go in elevators and make terrible jokes and just get over the fear of rejection. Get over the fear of, just what they say. Well, if you can get over the fear of rejection, you got it made.
Exactly. You know, Scott, when I was in college, I had a friend on the, which is surprising that I had a friend, but I had a friend on the faculty.
Really?
I had a friend on the faculty, this guy, Danny Daniels, who was a philosopher. Anyway, so I was talking with Danny once, and I said, you know, Danny, there's this guy who in my college who I think he doesn't like me, and I don't understand because I have so many different kinds of friends. And he said, it's kind of my narcissism. Everybody should like me. No matter how likable you are, there are going to be a group of people somewhere in California or New York who are going to hate your guts. So Danny said to me something that was really profound in my mind. He said, no matter what you do, there are going to be people who don't like you. And so one way of kind of an acceptance piece, no matter what you say, what you write, what lecture you give or workshop you do, there are going to be some people who don't like it. It just comes with the territory. And the question is, do you need everybody to like it?
Yeah, that's a really good point. Do you need that for your own self-esteem? Some people do.
It's like the idea that somehow I need to, this is kind of the maximizing need for approval. On the other hand, if you can accept, this is kind of like an ancient Aristotelian approach to virtue. If you act according to your values, to what you think is the right thing to do, if you act according to those values, that should direct your what you do and what you say, not the approval you get. So if you're among a lot of racists, you know, you might get a lot of approval by making racist comments, but you're not acting according to your values.
I hear you. Great point. I want to circle back to something I meant to ask you. I'm trying to reconcile the notion of let it go. I had Dan Pink on this podcast recently, and he said the only ones who let go of regret are psychopaths or little children. I wanted to get your thoughts about that. Like, it sounds like on the one hand, you're saying like, well, actually regret can be quite powerful in our lives, you know, can serve a useful function when it's productive. And the other hand, you're saying kind of let it go, like don't even worry about regrets. So I this is my little nuanced question.
Yeah. You know? So there's a, I have a whole chapter on guilt.
Oh yes, you say guilt is unfinished forgiveness is what you say. Love that.
So, you know, guilt, it's an interesting thing because one of the ways I think we grow in character is by what I would call productive guilt. And again, you have to think, why did guilt evolve? I mean, why is it every society has guilt and shame? I mean, guilt and shame are emotions that maintain social cohesion. They maintain the tribe. They maintain the group. They maintain trust. And so absolutely people who are in, like if you were looking for a life partner and somebody said, you know, gee, I really like you, Scott, but I have to tell you, I have no capacity for regret, shame or guilt. So can we pursue a lifelong relationship? You would want to run the other way.
No. Well, what if they said, I have no capacity for shame, guilt. What was the third one you said?
Regret.
Regret, but I have capacity for love. Would I run the other way?
I wouldn't believe them because I think to love my, to love my wife is to have capacity for being guilty, feeling guilty for something I've said that I think is wrong. And I think that that doesn't mean you feel stuck in the guilt. It's kind of like my experience with the concierge at the hotel, that I felt guilty. I felt this is not the kind of person I want to be. I want to apologize. Even if she doesn't forgive me, I want to do my part to try to make an effort to right the wrong. So I think the way of thinking about regret is to have regret about the right things to the right degree in the right way. It's very, very much like Aristotle's view of virtue. If we think about guilt, what we know is that people who are good at expressing a sincere apology are more likely to be trusted in the future. And people who other people in a work environment know are capable of guilt are viewed as more trustworthy in the work environment. So productive guilt is looking at your view and saying, is this the kind of person I want to be? Would I feel okay if somebody treated me this way? And then trying to learn from that experience and make a change. In other words, the guilt is the first step, and the next step is self-correction and growth and coming to terms with making yourself a better person, and if possible, making amends, making apologies if you can. And then ultimately forgiving yourself. That's not an example. That would not be an example of the balloon. That would be an example of bringing the balloon down and talking to the balloon and saying, you know something? I have to make an apology here.
Wow. Yeah, I really do love that phrase. Guilt is unfinished forgiveness. Yeah,
guilt is regret on steroids, too. It's like...
You're full of good quotes. you're like, let me give you an even better one. Well, let's end here today with a cheekiness where you talk about the 8 habits of highly regretful people. A couple of the things you say, like, well, dwell on all the negatives that you experienced and discount all the positives. Never accept trade-offs. When considering a choice, insist you need to know everything for sure before deciding. So let's just end on that cheeky note so that just people can also just kind of laugh at themselves a little bit, because I think that people just take, you know, maybe that's the maximizers that take themselves too seriously. Yeah. Maybe the satisficers have a little bit more of a sense of humor about the sort of inevitable imperfections of being human, right? Of human existence. Yeah.
If you take yourself too seriously, life is going to have the last laugh on you. So
oh my God, that's a great quote. Look at you.
I should have gone into advertising, not the psychology thing.
Or Hallmark cards. Look, I enjoyed so much chatting with you today. I really appreciate you coming back on the show, and I'm glad that we get you on here periodically when you get new books.
Oh, great. Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, no, I'm a big admirer of your work and really appreciate what you've done. Why don't we dedicate this episode to the memory of Aaron Beck.
Oh, God. Thank you. Yeah.
Tim Beck. I think he's a kind of a mutual friend of
Tim,
ours.
His birthday would have been a few days ago. Remarkable person. And so much of what I do, you know, is based on, you know, the inspiration and the knowledge and simply the way of inquiring that Tim Beck, you know, gave me over the years.
Yeah, let's dedicate this in his memory, and you're always welcome back on the show.
Can I tell you a funny anecdote before we leave? Yeah. So I was at a meeting at Beck's apartment about, I don't know, 7 years ago, and he said, you know, the Dalai Lama contacted me, and because I'm not able to travel because he was in a wheelchair, the Dalai Lama said he would come and visit me in Philadelphia, and he sat right in that chair right there, And then Tim said, well, and his people said, the Dalai Lama has requests about what he wants. And it was like an extensive list of foods that he wanted, you know, soup and salad, main course, dessert and all that. And I said, well, he sounds like a very hungry llama, doesn't he?
Did he laugh?
He did laugh.
Yeah. He's a great sense
he
of humor.
He does have a great sense of humor. You know, this is kind of a gratitude thing about, you know, looking back on your life and having access to memories of people who may be gone that we learned from and we loved. And I think that's the kind of part. And some people say live in the present moment. I think try to live in all the moments in your life. Try to gain from, I grew up very poor and I never want to forget growing up poor because it allows me to appreciate what I have. It allows me to understand other people are struggling. So it's good to be connected to people who gave you a lot, who are no longer here.
Let's leave on that note. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you, Scott.
Yeah, just for your extraordinary contribution to the field of psychology.
Thank you so much, Scott.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Psychology Podcast. If you'd like to react in some way to something you heard, I encourage you to join in the discussion at thepsychologypodcast.com or on our YouTube page, The Psychology Podcast. We also put up some videos of some episodes on our YouTube page as well, so you'll want to check that out. Thanks for being such a great supporter of the show, and tune in next time for more on the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity.